I'm going to talk, and I'll talk as fast as Jim Emron if I can. What I'd like to do is, and I don't think I'll have the time, but I'd like to try to cover two different ideas, two 10-minute papers. And the first one, I want to go quickly over my career as a mitocologist, if I can convince you that I am a mitocologist. And I'd like to show you how the reason that I've been successful as a mitocologist has to do with people like Everett Lindquist and Jerry Krantz and all the people that taught at the Acarology Summer Program when I was a student. Okay? And how unexpected this result was. If I can get through that fast enough, I'd like to bring you up to date on what I'm doing now. So Everett, there he is. First time I saw this paper, oh my God, every single CETA, he's got a name for it. But this was his classic work, and it comes out of what I think of his main thrust through his career, his interest in this large group that used to be called the Acidae, and is now actually a number of families and two superfamilies. He's maintained that level of expertise all the way through his career, constantly publishing in-depth analyses of taxa in that group. But he never stopped there. Okay? He also took on a completely different group of mites and became the specialist in there and produced several monographs and a whole swag of excellent papers describing new taxa and working out relationships. But he didn't stop there either. He also did a lot of basic taxonomic work supporting agricultural pests, and now he's taking on ticks. Okay, well, my career was hopefully not going to be anything like that. Actually, that looks like two. Okay, well, I came to mites because I'm at heart an ecologist. And when I found out you could take a handful of soil and have hundreds of species of animals living together in a single handful of soil, I was just blown away. How can they do that? Complete competitors cannot coexist. Are they partitioning the habitats? What are they doing? And I decided that I wanted to work on the cute mites. And I wasn't really sure that I needed to any taxonomy. I didn't need to call them species because we had operational taxonomic units. So that's how I did my master's, essentially, although Roy Norton forced me to start paying attention and looking at finer distinctions and trying to work at the species level. And then I decided to go to work under Jerry Krantz, the author of A Manual of Acarology. And although he's not a specialist in orbatted mites, people at Oregon State University, like Kermit Cromack, were interested in decomposition. And they had a grant in, and I was going to be the student looking at mites and dug fir logs as they decomposed. For 450 years, it was like a perfect signature. What happened when I got to Oregon State? Well, the grant didn't get funded. So for 2 years, I raised mosquitoes and things like that to stay employed. But then magically, a grant did get funded. But this was to look at the systematics of macrochelid mites that live in dung pats. My thesis, although I had no interest in taxonomy or systematics when I started, somehow I ended up a systematist. And I blame Jerry Krantz. But this is if I can claim that my career has been successful as a mitocologist, this is the primary reason that I've been successful, because I was forced to learn the taxonomy of mites, how to name the CD, how to identify them. Because if you can't identify things, you can't do ecology. And actually, you can't do systematics either. Okay, so that's what brought me to become a soil ecologist, a mitocologist. That's simply a sample under the snow in Alberta in December. Okay, the soil is full of lots of little things. Okay, all kinds of mites and insects and calendula. If you can't put names on them, you can't really work with them. Okay, my first postdoc. Essentially, I succeeded because they needed somebody to put names on things in soil food webs. And of course, I did mites, but this gave me an opportunity to work with calendula. It gave me an opportunity to work with people who worked with nematodes, nematologists, mycologists, protozoologists. And then I moved out of the soil onto plants. And magically, this ability to put names on mites allowed me to start working in a completely different system. You may know the work on Acrodomatia. Little mite huts on leaves. Now, up to now, I've described a couple of species, but only a couple. I did concentrate on ecology, Because I noticed when I published a taxonomic paper, two things happened. Acarologists treated me better, and nobody ever cited the paper. Okay, there's a phytostatid mite moving down into a demacium on a leaf on a rainforest tree in Australia. I went there to work with Dennis O'Dowd. And again, he needed somebody that could put names on mites. We had a very successful series there. This is one of my favorite shots that a graduate student, Dougal, did. There's a phytostatid mite lurking in this little cave. There's its front leg, about 150 microns long, got in the way of the razor. That's the opening to the demacium. That's the underside of the leaf, upper side of the leaf. These are the mite caves. And when the mite caves are present, you have predatory mites on the leaves, and they reduce the number of plant parasitic mites. It's an excellent system. Okay, I've had to put names on mites in Australia. Most Australian mites are not described. And I took the Phytosaidae as one group that I worked on. Now, as Hans will tell you, I'm no systematist. And it's probably arguable whether I'm actually a taxonomist, but I did manage to train a really good systematist and taxonomist, Jenny Beard, who should be out in the audience someplace. So that's my gift to taxonomy and systematics. Okay, that's just late. Well, once I was working on Demacia, I started looking around me. I'm above ground now, looking in the rainforest canopy. This is 35 meters up in the rainforest in Queensland. This is at the time when the canopy was the final frontier. Okay, this is after Terry Irwin took out that napkin in a pub and started scribbling down an estimated 30 million species of arthropods on Earth, right? A lot of interest. I looked at the papers. There were no mites. No mites in the rainforest canopy? Can that be true? Until you read the materials and methods closely, and they say, there were so many mites, we didn't know how to identify them, we poured them down the drain. So I started looking in the canopy, and again, I managed to find a lot of interesting information. There's 8,000 to 10,000 mites per square meter of foliage alone in many rainforests. And they're on the trunks, they're on the twigs, they're in the suspended soils. Suspended soil, that's soil that's up in the canopy. Now, there were a couple of papers saying that there are mites in that soil, but they're the same mites that are on the forest floor. They just walk up the trees. Okay? That didn't seem to be my experience, but how do you address that question? You can't address it unless you can identify the mites in the soil and the mites in the tree. You also can't do that unless you can climb. And as you might notice, I'm kind of rotund. So this was Fred's job. Here's a smiling face. He's probably never forgiven me. Okay, now that's a quick overview of my career. And my point is that taxonomy and ecology are closely related. That's kind of a duty name. It means arrangement method in Greek. Alpha taxonomy is the grunt work of taxonomy. It's identifying, describing, and putting names on species. If you can't do that, you can't do systematics, and you can't do ecology. All right? Therefore, clearly, taxonomy is an important science and highly respected by our society. So things like describing new species should show up in the pages of our highly respected journals. Correct? Well, if you find a femur bone of a hominid, you can describe a new species, and science and nature will fight for it. You find a new dinosaur that's a little bit attractive, that'll show up in science or nature. A new mammal species from the Mekong, a new bird from the Guinea Highlands. So arthropods, which are biodiversity, right? Well, Sean Winterton and I, for an interview article, actually went back through over 20 years of science and nature looking for new species of living arthropods that have been described. We found four. And none of them were really what you'd expect. The first one was a midge that lives in the Himalayas in a glacier. It was really about cold tolerance, not about a new species. Another was a major whitefly pest, and this was really about all these new technologies for determining species, not really about the new whitefly. Then there was the Mantophasmatoidea, a new order, no longer a new order, I'm afraid, but at the time it was a new order, that's a big deal. And the last one is the best, a snail-eating caterpillar. Oh, my. That's how you get to science. It's oh, my, or nature, when you work with things like we do. But oh, my, it was a Naaman Newton. They hadn't diagnosed it. So the author of this paper actually got two papers in science. They had to publish an addendum. Not a single mite. And I actually went back through all the years of science and nature that had been digitized at the time, and it doesn't look like a mite has ever been described in science. But you can get mites into science. Just ask John Mosher. He's put mites in science because, oh my goodness, look what they're doing with the fungi of the bark beetles. Is that correct? Pretty much. And I do get mites in science occasionally, but that's because I make pretty pictures. Oh my, this guy's mad about mites. There's the tuckerella that Ron was talking about. God knows what that is. It looks like a bat, though. Sometimes it's a sad thing. Not really an oh my, but oh how sad. Like when Bill Hamilton died, and they asked me for a picture of a parthenogenetic mite, okay, because of Bill's interest in sexual modes of reproduction and asexual modes of reproduction. Okay, so using my, I thought I might do this for a number of people, but I decided that'd be rude. So I've used my career. And last week I simply went to the Web of Knowledge, looked at my papers, and saw how many times each one had been cited. And I divided them into taxonomy systematics and ecology. 55, taxonomy systematics, 56, and ecology. I didn't look at the two most recent years. Okay, the green slime are the taxonomic papers. Okay, that's how many times they've been cited. The blue, these are both annual reviews on ecological subjects, Demacia, soil food webs. If you want to have success in academia, where managers, deans, department heads pay attention to these things, doing it as a taxonomist is going to be tough. That's one reason why taxonomists are disappearing. That's one major cause of the taxonomic impediment. It's nice to know that this one paper here, 81 citations for a taxonomic paper, it's with Everett and Bruce Halliday on Australian assets. Okay, now that's a quick review of what I've done. How am I doing for time? Okay. Now I'm in Alberta. How I ended up there is a bit of a long story, so I won't go into it. But I've decided that I should actually do what I know is right, rather than what I think will get me approbation from deans that might be pharmacologists, for example. Now, you probably don't know about Alberta, but it's a big place. It's not as big as Texas or Alaska, but it's like twice the size of Nevada. It's about 250,000 square miles. And it's been ice-free for between 9 and 10,000 years. That is, before then, nothing was alive there. It was covered with glaciers. Well, there were probably a few algae and nematodes, but that was it. And I say ice-free in a very relative sense. That's like 3 to 5 months if you're lucky. Most of the time, Alberta looks like this. But when it's not like that, it runs from the Rocky Mountains in the southwest, 3,800 meters, down to the mixed grass, short grass prairie and the Badlands, where all those dinosaur bones are found in the Morrison Formation in the southwest. But most of Alberta, is wetlands and forest. And these places are hardly explored at all. Those are all pictures by my wife, Heather. Okay, so just to recap, and the point I want to make here is there's a few roads in the southern half of the province, but once you get very far north, if you don't have a helicopter, you're not getting around. So much, I hope to your amazement, because certainly to mine, Alberta is now the site of this new model biodiversity assessment procedure called the Alberta Biodiversity Monitoring Institute. And I'll let you read what they do, go to their webpage. But it's extremely ambitious. They want to sample the entire province of Alberta to determine how the current biodiversity is, and then every 7 years, they want to repeat those samples to see if anything has changed. They're using a 20-kilometer grid. That's 1,656 sites. And the different colors are simply the different years of the rotations. Okay, now as we all know, biodiversity means birds. Okay? But in this case, they actually decided they should do some arachnids, and the arachnids they picked were orb-added mites, my original love. Now I moved to Alberta to retire, maybe working some bark beetle mites, but I didn't want to go to office every day, and I certainly didn't want to sit around on committees and do all the other crap that academics usually have to do. But I didn't want to sit at the microscope 40 hours a week, going crazy identifying things like a graduate student. But that's what I do. Why orb-addeds? But that same reason that first attracted me to them, there's a high alpha diversity. You take that handful of soil, there's a bunch of species. They have stable adult populations. That's very important for this because it's a single sample during the year. 5 minutes, okay? They're well-studied, good bioindicators, and are associated with soil health. They're only looking at the orbatids over 300 microns. So these are 11 orbatids from Alberta, all scaled to size, and that's a 300 micron hole. So the ones that go through the hole, we don't look at, just the larger ones. Okay. And all of this information is publicly available. Okay, you can go to the website right now and see all the information from 2007 to 2010. Eventually, there'll be ecological information as well, but right now it's just distribution. Okay. And there's a typical distribution map. So the yellow spots are areas sampled. The red spot is what were positive for this one species of mite. Now, as well, and I've updated this through this year's samples, which are almost finished, as well as doing the grid samples, so they do off-grid samples to try to evaluate how good they're estimating the human imprint, how much disturbance is affecting things. And I also do my own sampling in a variety of places. Where can you get all this information? Well, I've followed up on the ABMI idea, and I publish what I call the Almanac of Alberta Orbatida on the web. It's a living document, so I update it every time I get enough new information. It started with version 1.0. This is 2.3, which will be out soon. And in it are all the species that I've found that are relevant to the ABMI and keys to identify them all. Okay? So we have this giant species list with keys to identification, and I'm gradually adding illustrations to back up the keys. For example, here's a key to the Propelops of the world, because I needed to work out all the world species to figure out which ones are in Alberta. And more information, I put ecological information like the number of eggs or gut contents, whether they're bisexual or monosexual. Okay, well that's wonderful, right? But it's a species list. Is that science? It's a service to using these mites as bioindicators, but is it science? Well, I won't argue. I think it could be argued it's science, but it's not very... It's not that much fun, you know? It's not asking big questions. But that data, you can use it to ask big questions. So here are two species in the genus Propelops, Alaskensis and Canadensis. I've outlined their distributions. You see they look a bit complementary. If you put them together, there's something interesting going on here. What is it? So Canadensis is coming up from the south and then moving up along the Rockies. Alaskensis, guess where that was described? Alaska. Does anybody know anything about fossil history during the ice ages? The refugia, Beringia refugia? Uh-huh, okay. Probably, I would suspect, as a first approximation, Alaskensis survived the ice ages in Beringia, in Siberia, Alaska, and has moved down into Alberta from the north. And Canadensis was pushed down into the lower states, has come back up. Okay, is there other information we can use to test that hypothesis? Yes, because we're also looking at the CO2. Am I down to 2 minutes yet, or 2 minutes? Okay. I won't say much about this, except we use individual mites and recover the barcode from them. Okay, and the stars are where I've actually gotten barcodes from these mites. So you can see only 4 sites for Canadensis, but a good spread for Alaskensis. And if you look at this, see, Alaskensis is pretty uniform, very low genetic diversity. This bar represents 2% genetic distance. This is not a phylogenetic hypothesis. It's just nearest neighbor kind of overall similarity clumping. This particular one looks different, but it has a bunch of problems with the base pairs, so it's probably an artifact of the technique. But Canadensis is extremely diverse. Again, this would support this hypothesis that a single population from Beringia is invading from the north, and that multiple populations that were isolated during the ice ages are invading from the south. Okay, so here's the summary, lots of new records. I'm also trying to list all the rest of the mites in Alberta. So far, this is just a species list, but you have to start somewhere if you want to use mites in science. So that's all I have to say.